To CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
The way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end they always fall. Think of it. Always.
They seem invincible, but in the end they always fall. Always. A quote from Mahatma Gandhi.
Now for something completely different.
The Arctic is burning as never before. Scientist Jennifer Balch introduces new climate fast fires. Reports from the North Fire Front, a panel on Arctic wildfires at the Arctic Circle Assembly in October. Changes in the Arctic change the world, but it is a lawless land. Joint action in the Arctic is in a coma, with military in the wings. In fire and heat, natural violence is taking over all around the polar sea. Look north. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. In 2023, wildfire season in Canada burned an estimated 18.4 million hectares of land, which is over seven times the annual average of 2.5 million hectares. Everyone is in shock. This total area burned was larger than the entire state of North Dakota, about 70% of the population of Canada's Northwest Territories was evacuated, including residents of the territorial capital, Yellowknife. It was the horror year four fire in the Canadian North. Future fires will be measured against this record-smashing blackening of vast lands with clouds of carbon released into the atmosphere. Experts are still gasping and grasping what it means. In June 2024, intense wildfires above the Arctic Circle in Russia's far north, particularly in the Sakha Republic, released about 6.8 megatons of carbon into the atmosphere, third highest on record. Research published in September of this year demonstrated that the rise in Siberian wildfires is related to drought, drying soils, and decreased rainfall caused by Arctic warming. The study identified a potential feedback loop where wildfires suppress precipitation, further drying soils, and increasing fire likelihood. A study published in Nature Communications revealed that Arctic wildfires are causing unprecedented permafrost thawing and soil drying, leading to that destructive cycle of more intense fires. Researchers estimate burned acreage throughout Arctic areas will more than double as permafrost thaws. With the Arctic warming four times faster than the rest of the world, we need dialogue and cooperation among the nations who claim those Arctic lands and waters. The flimsy institutions trying to make that happen are dying or dead. You will hear from half the Arctic in this program. What is it like to live there now? New threats arise as we are lost in the human sideshow of greed, war, and politics. We investigate two more feedback loops forcing still more warming in the Arctic. First, introducing a new class of fires that hurts us most.
In your tracks of Arctic flame.
The news is still full of wildfires. Vast areas burn, releasing more carbon into the atmosphere. Health-wrecking smoke travels thousands of miles away. But if you live in a fire zone, there is a new class of fires, beasts that maybe cannot be stopped. And where is the new fire zone in climate times? Apparently, it includes New Jersey and New York City in November. A new study uncovers a type of fire that burns thousands of homes and kills more people. Jennifer Balch is Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Colorado, Boulder. Her latest paper is The Fastest Growing and Most Destructive Fires in the U.S. 2001 to 2020. Jennifer Balch, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
They say climate change is what happens to you while planning for something else. What have experts and our fire rating system missed until now?
We've been so focused on megafires and the size of wildfires that we've forgotten probably the most important aspect of fires for life safety and homes, which is their speed. We delineated a new class of fires called fast fires and determined how fast is too fast in terms of the number of structures destroyed. And it turns out that fires that grow more than 4,000 acres in a day are the ones that destroy structures and homes. And the ones that destroy more than 100 homes during a wildfire, those grow more than 21,000 acres in a day.
And that's about 1,600 hectares for our European listeners. So talk to us about changes in wildfires now compared to the 1980s and 90s. Are they different?
They are, and there's been a lot of work in the fire science community showing that fires are getting bigger, fires are getting more intense, they're getting more severe, and we're now the first to also add that fires are also getting faster. They're getting faster across the West, 250% faster in just a couple of decades. And in California, they're 400% faster in just a couple of decades.
That's amazing stuff. I know that science often has to settle for long-term averages and statistics. How was your team able to spot events that develop in just one day and might disappear days later?
Yeah, we are experts at using satellite imagery to see fires and track them through time. And we developed an algorithm that essentially reconstructs how fires spread and how they grew over time on a daily basis. And so it was with that technology that we were able to determine for 60,000 wildfires how they grew and moved over time.
I see PBS Terra made a decent documentary about your new science, and in it, host Maya May says, quote, "As the wind drops in elevation, atmospheric pressure increases, which dries and warms the air. Temperatures can increase by as much as 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit for every 1,000 feet of lost elevation." That is a lot to understand. Can you describe these downslope fires, which PBS suggests may be unstoppable?
Yeah, that's a phenomenon that we see wherever we have mountainous terrain, and we have different names for those types of winds in different regions. So they call them the Santa Anas in Southern California. We call them the Chinooks here in Colorado. They're also called sundowners. And so the basics of it are that as winds move downslope, they are essentially hotter and drier as a function of a change in elevation. And they can also move quite quickly as well. And so those types of winds are winds that are really challenging in a fire scenario because they shift the firefighting capacity from suppressing the fire and putting out home ignitions to life safety and evacuation and getting people out. We experienced that here in Colorado. California has experienced it. Lahaina has experienced it as well. And so we do need to be aware of where we're building homes into landscapes that have a propensity for these types of winds.
Yeah, the Marshall Fire in Colorado, December 30th, 2021, it destroyed 1,000 homes in 6 hours. It's the worst in state history. Could you describe what happens when a fast fire arrives? How do people and firefighters respond?
Yeah, well, that one was right in my backyard, less than a mile from my own house, and it was a pretty devastating event for our community. That fire started in an open space system, a grassland system, and there were 110-mile-an-hour winds happening that day. We all knew that there were going to be high wind conditions, you know, unfortunately, there were fire ignitions in the mix, and that's what started these grassland fires from human-related causes. That fire took off in the open space in grasses and essentially became a couple miles of active fire line moving through the open space and then hit neighborhoods on the eastern side of the foothills or the Rocky Mountains here in Colorado and started neighborhoods on fire through, you know, a lot of ember ignitions. Wood fencing started on fire, wood siding started on fire, and then it became really an urban conflagration where Chuck E. Cheese was evacuated, Costco was evacuated, there was a hotel that burned down, it jumped, you know, major multi-lane freeways because of the ember cast across really large distances. It fundamentally changed how I conceive of the wildland-urban interface, essentially where homes intermix with flammable vegetation. And under high wind conditions, you know, we can get fires in anything that will burn, even in suburbia.
Yeah, the public thinks forest fires, but you find more homes are lost in grassland fires, and then now we have urban fires.
That's right. We found that the most of the fast fires are actually happening in grassland system, which makes sense. And part of the reason why is because grasses are really fine, flashy fuels. They dry out really quickly. They catch on fire really quickly. And it's very easy for fire to move through them. Kind of have these images of smoky bear in the forest, but really the fires that are destroying our homes are the ones that are happening in grassland systems where it's very hard to suppress those fires given how fast they move.
And the hellish fire that burned through the town of Jasper, Alberta last summer was also driven by heavy winds. The park and the whole town were evacuated within hours of it starting. That it had to be. And I wonder if that was another fast fire, and will you explore this new class of danger in other countries?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we've made publicly available the data set that we derived from satellite imagery for the whole globe. So we will continue to pursue this question and better understand fast-moving events, you know, particularly in the context of, you know, I do worry about the next Paradise or the next Lahaina or the next Marshall Fire. I don't think we're going to see a future where we don't see more devastating events. And I would like the science to help inform, you know, where do we expect communities to be most at risk from fast fires? Can we help prepare them or prepare communities across the West where we have one way in, one way out towns, better prepare them for this type of risk in terms of their evacuation planning or in terms of how they're mitigating the risk proactively. You know, the one positive upshot here is that we can do something about fire. We can build better. We can burn better. It costs the same today to build a conventional home as it does to build one that's fire resilient. And so we know that 80% of the wildland urban interface is undeveloped. And so what we need to be thinking about right now is how we're building into flammable landscapes to shift this equation and this risk factor.
One other thing I think we need to point out to listeners, obviously a hotter planet and drought add to wildfire danger, but the increase in explosive fire is not only due to climate change. What else is playing into this phenomenon that we should look out?
Yeah, there's also fuels. So fire needs warm conditions, it needs fuel to burn, and it needs an ignition source. And so people are changing all three of those, and I've studied all three of those pieces. We know that across the U.S., the vast majority of ignitions are coming from human-related ignitions, whether they're accidental or whether they're infrastructure-related, like power lines. We also know that, you know, we're changing fuels in the way that we fragment the landscape, in the way that we introduce invasive grasses, our road infrastructure. You know, there are a lot of different ways that we're changing fuels for fire. And so part of it is, you know, with fire suppression for many, many decades, in fact, a couple of centuries, we've removed, you know, fire's role in reducing fuels in the landscape. And we try and mimic that through thinning, prescribed fire, other fuel mitigation efforts. But the challenge is that it's really hard to catch up with where we need to be in terms of fuel reduction and the way that fire used to work in our landscapes. You know, we do also need to mitigate the fuels around where people live. You know, I think it's important to focus those resources and energy where people live and work as opposed to in the middle of the woods where nobody is, given how hard and expensive it is. But that's part of the solution as well, is to think about the fuels. And also our homes are fuels too, and thinking about how we're building and what material we're building with, you know, whether we have wood decking or the roof fence on our homes. There's a lot of ways we can improve the fire resistance of our homes.
So we're talking about a tiny fraction of wildfires, maybe less than 3% of the 60,000 fires in your study. And yet these really are the ones to pay attention to and not necessarily the big ones. How is that changing the way fire suppression works, the way responders are having to operate?
Well, I think they're really challenging result out of our studies that we know fires are getting faster, so it's getting even harder to be a firefighter, and frankly we're asking too much of our firefighting community given that we're building homes in flammable places. We have a warming climate and then we expect them to put fires out. You know, I think more and more what it means is that firefighting communities are going to have to focus on the life safety aspect and the evacuation piece. But it's not just their problem. It's also, you know, at the level of communities and land use planning of, like, how do we incorporate that into thinking about future development? And, you know, are there enough exit routes? Are communities prepared to leave? Do they have enough information? Are warning systems, are they in place? Are they functioning in the way that we need them to be during an emergency? There's a lot of aspects to this problem. It's not just firefighters putting it all on the shoulders of firefighters.
I live in a fire zone, and we don't have summers now. We have fire season. We just unpacked our bug-out bags a few days ago in November. And somehow we have to teach millions of people to believe in these warnings and to react more quickly than their parents ever had to. How can we improve the warning system and improve public reaction so we can deal with these very fast fires?
I think we need to target, first of all, where we expect fast fires to happen, and understand limited community evacuation routes. And, you know, that's a west-wide problem, because we also know that fast fires can happen pretty much anywhere across the West. It really does come down to where we expect high wind conditions, high winds can be anywhere. So, you know, what that means is that we really need to prepare communities that have one way in, one way out towns, that expect to have, you know, high traffic scenarios in evacuation conditions and scenarios. And I don't think we're where we need to be.
Yeah, what was the resort town that had that one way in, one way out, and then they had a lot of trouble getting people in and out? Do you remember?
I'm not sure if you're talking about one this year, or, you know, I do know we had a scenario in Estes Park, which is just outside of, north of Denver, outside of Rocky Mountain National Park, a lot of visitation. So it could have very high population density based on the influx of tourists. And we had a very fast-moving event called East Troublesome Fire that jumped the Continental Divide through tundra and essentially, you know, bare soil over a mile and came bearing down on this town. And it was, you know, a traffic nightmare in that town. And fortunately, the weather and the wind shifted. But that was a very scary couple of days for that town. And it's, you know, emblematic of a lot of mountain towns across the West where, you know, we have a lot of people living in very, you know, dispersed but fundamentally not as many road networks to get them out.
And this is based on hard data from NASA space monitoring and all kinds of ground-based fire records. And as you said, you found increases in fire behavior, like 250% more, almost 400% increase since just 2001. Could you talk to us about the impacts of climate change on fire behavior as you see it?
Yeah, it's a really great question, and we haven't tested yet the link between warmer temperatures and fire spread, but I can tell you that we expect that to be part of the equation, given that we know that fire responds really strongly to warming. In fact, it takes just a little bit of warming to lead to a lot more burning in terms of area. We know that it is expected to change intensities because more fuel is available. So and that's been documented on a global scale, that we've seen an increase in intensity, and even at night as well, that some of our other work that looked at, we're losing the brakes on fire at night, as well as we've got our foot on the gas pedal during the day on wildfires. So we know that temperature increase has a big impact on fire behavior. And I do expect that with warming temperatures, with fuels being drier and more available, that would also increase the speed at which fires are moving.
What do you think you and your colleagues will be working on next?
Yeah, I think a big one is trying to understand where risk is highest in our western towns. In terms of where we might expect to see fast fires and limited evacuation. So we really do want the science to be useful and to help inform our communities and help us better prepare.
From the University of Colorado, we've been speaking with Dr. Jennifer Balch. She is the lead author of the new paper, The Fastest Growing and Most Destructive Fires in the U.S. 2001 to 2020. You can find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Jennifer, thank you for sharing this new understanding of fire with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
What is it like to live in the fastest heating place in the world? Is that where the future of this whole planet will be written? We're about to listen to a panel with high-level speakers on what this barrage of wildfires in recent years means for the people in the Arctic, but also about a looming climate disaster if the boreal forest continues to burn. I'm going to tell you who the speakers are, but you will be surprised. These are not the bland platitudes you would expect. The speakers are Lisa Murkowski, United States Senator, Yvonne Jones, Parliamentary Secretary to the Canadian Minister of Northern Affairs and to the Minister of National Defense, Edward Alexander, Co-Chair, Gwich'in Council International, Co-Lead of the Norwegian Chairship of the Wildlands Fire Initiative. We'll hear more about that. Maria Vartaresian, State Secretary, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Norway. Normally, we just don't expect much from the official peoples, but none of that here. I was surprised when American Senator Lisa Murkowski spoke for everyone in the firing line from the far north to Carolina. We hear for the first time, for many of us, the real news from the Canadian Arctic. Edward Alexander gives us the experience of the original population of the Arctic, still there and still strong. And then a secretary of the giant petrol state Norway admits that burning fossil fuels is the main driver behind this burning in the north. This is, as you expect on Radio EcoShock, news you need to know. The panel discussion comes courtesy of the nonprofit group Arctic Circle. Don't confuse that with the politicians who represent 8 countries in the Arctic. That's the Arctic Council. And that's currently non-functional because of geopolitical issues. I'll tell you more about that in that breakdown in the Arctic later on. The first question goes to Senator Murkowski.
Unfortunately, summers in the interior particularly, have come to not be referred to as summer season, it's fire season. And a fire season means that even when the temperatures are finally comfortable and warm, your family may be inside because your children or your grandparents may have respiratory issues, or it's just not safe to be breathing the air. The soccer tournaments are canceled because it is not safe for the children to be out and engaging in vigorous exercise. It is a level of health safety, I think, that we think of first. In the interior, where I went to high school in Fairbanks, at that time, I didn't know a single person who had air conditioning, much less even a fan. And so your reality is we are dealing with an environment during the summertime particularly that has caused extraordinary concerns from a health perspective. It has been practice in Alaska over the decades with our extensive wildlands that the way that we handled the fires was the fires would burn unless there was threat to personal property or to families themselves. And then we would attack the fire. This past summer, as you noted, the amount of acres that were burned was relatively small. But where the McDonald fire was concentrated was right in the Fairbanks. It was in the metropolitan area. It was surrounding Eielson Air Force Base, Fort Wainwright, where significant populations live. So no homes were burned, but you literally had a community that was shut down, shut in. We're seeing not only the impacts to the people, but we're seeing the impacts to the land. When you have vegetation burn, and when you have, for instance, black spruce, which is the predominant spruce that is there, when they burn, they take a long time to recover. And what recovers then are the quicker growing trees that do not provide for the same level of protection for the permafrost when those trees are no longer there. So we're seeing a change in vegetation. So we're not only harming individuals with their health, but we're also exacerbating accelerated permafrost thaw, what that means from an accelerated carbon emissions. One last point, as my time is expired here. We in Alaska have, with our fires historically, seen about one half the nation's emissions as a consequence of these wildland fires. And yet just 4% of our fire budget country goes to Alaska. So we've got to flip that in terms of understanding what it means to better contain our fires, not only from a health perspective, but I'm hoping that my friend Edward will speak to what it means for just the health of the land itself and the animals and those who subsist upon it.
Parliamentary Secretary Jones, in this spring, Canadian officials warned that 2024 could bring an unprecedented fire season, potentially even surpassing the extreme fire season we saw in 2023 in Canada, which was dubbed the year of all records. 2024 was severe, but it was luckily not as catastrophic as anticipated. But it still highlights that there is a shifting baseline of what we consider a normal. So could you speak to what this evolving new normal means to communities in the Arctic and Canada?
Yvonne Jones, Parliamentary Secretary, Canada.
Thank you for the question. It's definitely a new normal in terms of wildfires for us in Canada. And I'll just give you an example. When we say we think it's going to be a worse year or a better year, our standard of measurement is all gauged by 2023 now in Canada, where we had the worst wildfire in our history, destroyed 15 million hectares of land, which is about the size of England. So if you want to put it in perspective, it affected communities, it affected people, businesses, all aspects of life. Actually, this morning I met with the Arctic Economic Council, and one of the members actually is representing Northwest Hull in the Yukon. They had just finished the fiber optic network, the only fiber optic network through the territory, connecting the communities, and they lost the infrastructure. you know, through wildfires, and that all had to replace. So it left people without connectivity for a period of time, but it also destroyed things like the pole lines. So it took out the power for many months. You know, tens, thousands of people were evacuated. Only one highway, if you're lucky to have a highway in most Arctic regions.